Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Web Sleuths Radio. I am so glad you're with me tonight. Let's get right to the legal goo, shall we? The opinions expressed on Web Sleuths Radio are those of the host and the guests and are not connected in any way, shape, or form to websleuths.com, which is a totally and completely separate corporate entity, no less. Joining us tonight is journalist and true crime author Sunny Long. Sunny has a new book out called Among Murderers and Madness. It's the story of the Butts family triple homicide. Also joining us a bit later, Florida attorney Richard Hornsby. Richard will help us understand all the legal maneuvering in the George Zimmerman case. And Kimster is here. Kimster is our executive producer of Web Sleuths Radio. And a lot of people don't know this, but Kimster is also the CEO of our Web Sleuths Incorporated West Coast Division, Northwest Pacific Chapter. And Kimster is in charge of our Web Sleuths Clown School. She really is. Hey, do you watch My Strange Addiction on TLC? I do. I can't help it. It's like a train wreck. It's like a train wreck of naked people. You can't help but look and point. Some of the highlights: woman addicted to drinking nail polish, at least 5 bottles a day. There is a woman chewing up to 200 feet of scotch tape a day. She chews little bits and pieces and spits it out all over the house. There was a woman addicted to snorting piles of baby powder. I mean, she would get a huge pile and then just shove it in her face and snort, like, just gobs of it, just, you know, cups and cups of it up her nose, and she had baby powder covering everything in her house. There was a woman addicted to digging in her ears. Now, we are going to mention the fact it just seems like a lot of women have these problems, but there are guys. There was a man addicted to loving his car. It was kind of gross and weird. I won't go into details, but somehow a man loving his car didn't surprise me in the least. But one of my favorites was the person addicted to cleaning. Now, I want to marry someone with that addiction. I want to marry someone who's addicted to cleaning, addicted to cooking, and addicted to telling me how thin I look. So if you know anybody like that, let me know. I will marry them instantly. My point is this. Why do these people do weird things? If they could stop on their own, don't you think they would? We can't sit there and go, why don't they stop? My gosh, they would if they could. It's not about self-control. My addiction is about people who are out of control. They have compulsions that are overwhelming them that they cannot control, which leads me to crime. There are lots of criminals who have compulsions. Should we help them too? Well, I think we should, but we should also punish them, because just because you have a compulsion doesn't mean that you can't be liable for your acts. And that's what we need to remember. Now, I predict the day will come when we will be able to scientifically rewire people's minds to where they won't commit crimes, to where they can't tell lies, to where we will no longer have to live in fear of killers or people who choose to eat toilet paper at the movie house. That day is coming, but until then, it's going to be up to us and up to people like author Sunny Long to tell us the story and to keep crime on our top of mind awareness to keep us safe. We have a very, very strange case we're going to talk about. Very strange, very emotional, and a long, drawn-out case. We're going to discuss it first off before we get to George Zimmerman. Jerry Fay, Jessica, and Mackenzie Butts were murdered in January of 1992 by a man who, even though pleaded guilty, still maintains his innocence. Journalist Sunny Long has been following the case of the Butts murder since day one. Sunny has formed a close friendship with those close to the family. His book, Among Murderers and Madness, is a 20-year journey into this very tragic tale, and it's available right now as we speak on Amazon. And welcome, Mr. Long. Thank you for joining us on Web Sleuths Radio.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the work you do in keeping crimes like this and others in the public eye.
Well, thank you. Now, let's talk about the Butts murder. I've been familiar with the Butts murder for quite a while, but I did not realize all the twists and turns in this case. So why don't you give us a quick Reader's Digest version, an overview of the crime itself, and then we'll go from there.
I'll certainly do that. I'll try to do my best. January 27, 1992 was a Monday, the day after the Super Bowl. Jerry Fay, as you mentioned, Jessica and Mackenzie were found in their Atlanta, Texas mobile home. Now, Atlanta is a small town of about 6,000 near Texarkana, near Shreveport, Louisiana, East Texas, basically. No arrests were made for 3 months, and then in March, Kevin Haley, who was Jerry Fay's former boyfriend and lived three blocks down the road, also the son of a deputy sheriff in the town, was arrested. Now, Kevin stayed in jail for 3 months until a probable cause hearing was held in June of 92, and his bond was lowered and he was released until the case could be taken to a grand jury. The grand jury that October returned a no bill, pretty much dropping the charges basically against Kevin, and that's the way it stayed for a long, long time. Catching my breath as I move along, because this is a long case. So we're talking 1992 now. So in 2000, let me back up just a second. In 1996, okay. 1996, a quote-unquote found DNA report was released by the Atlanta police that indicated the DNA found under Jerry Fay, the mom's fingernails, was not Kevin Haley's.
Really?
So of course the media was writing, well, original suspect, not the killer, that kind of thing. So the case pretty much went dormant for another 5 years or so until a Atlanta police officer named Mark West asked his chief, you know, can I take another look at this? Can I take, you know, it's been quite a while since the, almost 10 years since the case, and the chief said, of course. And in 10 years from 92 to 2002, DNA technology improved quite a bit.
Yes.
Mitochondrial DNA came into the realm, and evidence was retested, and some things that hadn't been tested were tested, and DNA came back to, guess who, Kevin Haley.
Yeah, what a shock.
So let me
stop you right here and ask
you
a question.
Thank you.
The DNA test that they did that showed it wasn't Kevin Haley's, was that
right.
one that was retested, or was that just extra DNA that was under her fingernails?
That was DNA that was under her fingernails at the time, and of course there was just a small sample, and there was nothing to be
okay.
retested again.
And that, yeah. and that, okay, so basically this is, and I think this is very important, Sonny Long, author of Murders Among Madness. It's important to note that just because somebody finds DNA on something doesn't mean it had to. It doesn't mean you've solved the case. It doesn't
right.
mean that you've eliminated somebody. It doesn't mean that you've found someone that has killed somebody. You have
right.
to, and you know, unless it's rape and it's semen or something real specific, but especially under the fingernails. If we all clipped our fingernails right now, we'd have all kinds of weird DNA under our fingernails.
Right.
That doesn't mean that we went out and, you know, had an affair with the person whose DNA we have under our fingernails. It was just there. So I think that's very important to remember. So now they've improved the DNA, and Kevin Haley is arrested, right?
Correct. Actually, and it's just, that's why this is such an interesting story. In the meantime, before 2007, he had gotten into some more trouble and was actually serving time in a Louisiana prison for attempted murder. So he's in Angola and brought back to Texas, and in 2007 is indicted for the murder of Jerry Fay, Jessica, and McKenzie. 2 years later, after some, you know, going through the legal system and pretrial hearings, and when they were ready to start jury selection, Kevin and the state of Texas made a plea agreement. Kevin admitted killing Jerry Fay, but would not admit to killing the two children, and was sentenced to life in prison to run concurrently with the sentence he was serving in Louisiana.
Does he have a
chance? That's where we stand today.
Does he have a chance?
No, he does. No,
okay.
No, he does not.
Okay, so now we have this young mother and her two children, and this guy who claims his innocence, but just happens to be in prison because he tried to kill somebody else. Isn't it amazing that people around him are either dead or apparently someone tries to kill them? He just happens to be there. So here we have this young mother.
I'm sorry, Tricia.
No, go ahead, please.
Yeah. No, I've often said he either did it or he's the unluckiest son of a gun in the world. So.
Exactly. You've got it. You know, that's what always just gets to me, Sonny, is when criminals say, well, I didn't do it, but yet every time they show up, something bad happens. And it's like, come on, you know, we're not idiots here. Okay, so we're talking about the Butts Triple Murder with Sonny Long. He is the journalist and author of the book Among Murders and Madness, a triple homicide case that happened in 1992. But through your 20-year journey, Sonny, you have come up with all kinds of – it had just so many interesting twists and turns through this whole thing. But why did he kill them? I mean, he obviously killed the kids. He just doesn't want to admit it. How did he know them? What was the deal? What happened?
He and Jerry Fay were intimate. They were boyfriend, girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
and lived, like I said, only three blocks from each other. So they knew each other well. He knew the kids. They had, I believe, the relationship was no longer an active one at this time. But Jerry Faye was no saint herself, and her friends admit, and there's evidence that shows that she was probably selling a little marijuana at the time, and Kevin was a customer. It was also Super Bowl night, and he admits he'd been out drinking and smoking and doing cocaine all day. So my theory is that he walked down there from, he lived down the block with his grandmother's house. My theory is that he walked down there and knocked on the door and wanted to visit with Jerry Faye for a little while at the end of a long night of partying. And then she maybe didn't want to, or was late, and he I think he evidence shows that he already owed her a little bit of money. Maybe she, you know, got upset about that. And from talking to her family and friends, she is the kind of person that would have gotten in his face probably, and probably maybe perhaps it escalated from there. Another of the quirks of the case is that the three people were all killed by different means. Jerry Faye, it was thought at first because of a nearby pillow, they thought she had been smothered, but I think evidence later showed that she was actually strangled. Mm-hmm. Jessica, the 11-year-old, was found on the bed with a telephone cord wrapped around her neck, and the poor baby Mackenzie was found floating face down in the bathtub in a couple of inches of water. So another
he just lost it. He just lost it and went from victim to victim and doing his sick, twisted whatever it was. Did he sexually assault anyone?
There was some signs of penetration on Jessica. There was no semen. The theory, I've talked to some of the policemen that investigated the case, is that perhaps he was trying to make it look like it was a sexual assault case or a break-in or something. And, of course, with the three different people dying by three different means, the question of was he alone has always been out there, too. You know, did he do it by himself? The apartment didn't look like there had been a struggle. Did someone come over and help him clean up? You know, there's just still so many questions about the case, even though he's sitting in prison for one of them with someone else there with him. Yeah.
What do you think? Do you think Kevin Haley acted alone in the murder of the Butts family?
I think there's evidence that shows. Oh, gosh. You know, Trish, that's just a question that's probably going to haunt me forever, and I wish someone. If he wasn't, he should tell us, you know, who else was there.
You would think he would. I'm sure he's the type of guy that would roll over on somebody if he thought it would help him. You know, and the thing is, you have to remember, if he overpowered the mom first, the kids wouldn't put up much of a struggle.
And the kid ran for the 11-year-old ran for the phone to call for help.
There wouldn't be much of a mess, I wouldn't think. You know, so
yeah,
I could see
Jerry Faye and him struggled just a little bit, but that's the other interesting aspect of this case is actually Kevin's mother.
Yes, I wanted to get into Kevin's mother. Yeah. Oh man, whoa!
Her name is Kathy Weaver, and she is also in prison for murder. She murdered her husband and got away with it for two years. Yeah, being ruled a suicide for 2 years until another one of her sons was upset that she wasn't giving him as much money as she was giving Kevin, and he wore a wire for the police, and she basically confessed to that. But she's a big influence over Kevin, I believe.
What did she do? I mean, what type of – I'm always fascinated by people's childhood, and I'm not saying this excuses it, so everyone don't freak out. I'm not saying a childhood excuses a behavior, but I do think it creates the person that, in the future creates a behavior. What was his childhood like? Obviously, his mother is a very twisted person as well.
Yeah, apparently, of course, it was a divorced family. He, I think he lived with his dad some and his mom some, and at some point, of course, at the time of the murders, was living with grandparents. So it's one of those situations where you get passed around. I did interview his father, and his father talked about him being a good a popular kid in school and a good kid and involved in high school sports and the chess club and those kinds of things. And that's probably all true, but at some point, drugs got in the equation, and I think that may have had a lot to do with it.
Okay, so let's talk about his mother. And I'm sorry, what was Kevin Haley's mother name? What was
Kathy
her name?
Weaver.
Kathy Weaver. Let's talk about Kathy Weaver, the charming Kathy Weaver. How did she get away with this for so long? She's in prison now for murdering her husband, but they thought it was a suicide. Correct. What did she do to him?
She was shot. He was shot in in the bed in their Atlanta home with a rifle nearby and a suicide note of sorts. And she staged the scene, obviously, to make it look like he shot himself. And she was there, and she called the cops and said, you know, this is apparently what happened. And again, another son of hers at one point wore a wire and got her to say that he got what he deserved.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about that, and I'll never be able to prove it, and Kathy would never admit it to me, her husband's name was Mike Scott.
Mm-hmm.
The man who arrested Kevin for murder, his name, he was the Atlanta police chief, his name just happened to be Mike Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, she married a man by the same name. And I just know, in her twisted mind, that she was killing police chief Mike Scott.
There
you
go.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
I just know that
was her rationale.
Mm-hmm.
So, but she's not a nice person at all.
No,
she's
not. Now, this is a very, very interesting book. It's called Murder, Among Murderers and Madness. You can go to Amazon.com. Just look up Sunny Long, SunnyLong, and you'll be able to find the book, and it's definitely worth the read. You met Kevin Haley, the man convicted of killing Jerry Faye, Jessica, and Mackenzie Butts, did you not?
I did. It was actually a sort of a happenstance meeting in a subway,
oh, wow.
Restaurant, not a underground subway.
Right.
He came in with someone I knew, and we shook hands. This was many years after the murder, when he was free, of course. And
mm-hmm.
And he wasn't very comfortable, and they left pretty quickly. Now, I never have had the opportunity to sit down and interview him. I asked, and he turned me down. But we have corresponded. He sent me letters from prison. That's where. He continues to say he's innocent, even though he made the plea agreement. But I've exchanged letters with him. I'm sorry.
Why did he make the plea agreement? Was it because of the DNA, do you think?
Well, number one, to take the death penalty off the table.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of evidence that could possibly provide reasonable doubt. He did not want to take the chance that when you start getting involved, children involved, and previous crimes involved, that he didn't want to take a chance with a jury with a
mm-hmm.
death penalty on the table. And there's a lot of evidence against him. I'm not saying there's not. The new DNA evidence found was the clincher. There was actually some blood found on Jerry Faye's T-shirt that they believe could only have gotten there the night of the murder. So.
And so they don't think the argument that, well, I've been to her house and I had a nosebleed, that didn't
wash, right?
Well,
there was prints found, there was hairs found, but he said, yeah, I've been in and out of his house hundreds of times. So,
mm-hmm.
And it's kind of hard to date those kinds of things.
Right.
Unless there's, you know, other ways to assure that it was there at a certain period of time.
Well, it's the totality of the evidence as well. It's
correct.
Not just the one
correct.
Thing, as we said. And, again, this
exactly.
is a perfect case that you do not put all your eggs in the DNA basket here. Because we all have foreign DNA under our fingernails and in our underwear and on our body, and it doesn't mean anything. Sunny Long, what is the strangest thing about the Butts murder case and this book? I mean, it's a 20-year journey for you, and you felt
what?
Strong enough to write a book. Tell us the strangest, most odd thing about this situation.
Probably one of the people that was kind of on the periphery of the case, but... he actually confessed to the murders. He was the boyfriend of Jerry Faye's mother at the time of the murder, the
mm-hmm.
Jerry Faye being the adult that died. His mother's, her mother's boyfriend at the time was a man by the name of Brett Lawless. Now, Brett was in prison on another charge, and he confessed to the Butts murders, but the problem was he had shaved all his body hair off, and I mean all of it, and started calling himself Beverly.
Oh, my God.
So his credibility was shot a little bit. And he also confessed to some other murders and said that people were still around because the CIA or the FBI, one of them, cloned him.
Oh, so
him,
he's
and he
paranoid
was, so that's the madness in the title. That's his picture on the cover. Also. Kevin's large on the cover, and then Kathy
mm-hmm.
Weaver and Brett Lawless are smaller
okay.
on the cover.
Oh, I was
so
wondering
yeah.
why they look different. Okay, that's Kevin.
Yeah.
Oh. Well,
Kevin's
poor,
the big picture, and the other
right.
two are Kathy and Brett. Yeah.
Well, poor Jerry Faye. Her mom, that was her boyfriend. I can't imagine what her life
later,
was.
Later, her husband, actually. Yeah.
Her husband, so, yeah.
Now,
I can't imagine.
Yeah. And now divorced, of course. Yeah.
Well,
now
yeah.
divorced, of course. But
I hope so.
And he didn't meet such a good fate in prison either. So
oh dear.
But that was just bizarre when he, you know, we're thinking, oh, he confessed, we've got something, and then
and all of that came
not,
out.
Not as, yeah.
Well, I know everybody listening and listening later on to this show when it goes up on the web, you're all true crime buffs, and this is written for you, and you will love the book. It's Among Murderers and Madness. Go to Amazon.com. If you can't remember the title, you can remember the last name, Sonny Long, S-O-N-N-Y-L-O-N-G. Mr. Long, it has been a pleasure. And if there's any new developments in this case, let us know, and we'll have you back on, and we'll discuss it, okay?
Again, Tricia, I really appreciate the opportunity. And, you know, the book's written from basically from my perspective. I'm telling,
right.
you know, as I see things unfold and as I make befriend and talk to law enforcement and the family and the suspect's family. And it's just, you know, a journalist, I guess, view of this thing as it unfolds. Of course, there's police reports and there's testimony from the courtroom and those kinds of things that you would expect to find in a book. But it's also, you know, a personal journey, too.
Exactly. And the thing is, it is a book written because you've met so many of the people involved and actually talked with them and got to know
right.
them and became friends with the family. So it's not just an author who's looked up a bunch of information
right.
and put it in a book. You've been there on the ground interviewing people and being right in the thick of things. And that's what
Absolutely.
Makes the book so fascinating. Again, the book Among Murderers and Madness by Sonny Long. Mr. Long, thank you so much for joining us on Web Sleuths Radio, and we will have you back very, very soon, or if perhaps there's a development, even sooner, okay?
Thanks again, and keep up your good work.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sonny Long, the author of Among Murderers and Madness, a great book. You've really got to check it out. Okay, now it's the case that just gets hotter and hotter and hotter. As the temperatures rise in our lives, it also rises in the case of George Zimmerman. He is charged with second-degree murder with killing Trayvon Martin. And here to help us make sense of it again is the voice of reason, attorney Richard Hornsby. Check out his website, richardhornsby.com. And Richard, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's get right to it here. George Zimmerman was given a $150,000 bond, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Oh, I want to read you something first.
Okay.
This comes from Cheryl McCollum. We had her on last week, and she was going to try and be on the show with us tonight, and she couldn't make it. But she wanted me to let you and everybody else know the following, okay? George Zimmerman is not a flight risk. That's why he made bond. He did not flee the scene. He did not flee the state. Basically, the judge really had no choice, to be fair. That's what Cheryl McCollum, in so many words, I'm paraphrasing basically what she said. Now, what do you feel about that comment? Is that basically why he got bond? Is this what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, I don't really know what... I don't know who Cheryl McCollum is, sorry to say, but the way Florida law works is pretty clear, is that unless the state is prepared to prove that the proof is evident, the presumption is great, and that those key words, basically it's been interpreted to mean beyond a reasonable doubt, that's how strong the evidence is against somebody, that a judge can't hold somebody without bond. So there was never a question about whether or not he was going to be granted bond. The only question was going to be how much bond. And then the second legal principle that applies is that a judge can't set a bond any higher than is necessary to ensure that a person appears.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and that just means, you know, and so the judge couldn't set $1 million because $1 million wasn't necessary to make sure Mr. Zimmerman appeared. Unless, you know, of course they had evidence to say he was a flight risk or something like that, then that might have, you know, caused a judge. This was a foregone, the bond was a foregone conclusion to me. I don't, for anybody to even make it sound like it was an issue is, I really don't think, you know, being either A, honest with people, or B, knows Florida law very well.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of questions coming from our chat room, and I want to get to one of them right away. Steely Dan says, I keep hearing that the prosecution made mistakes when George Zimmerman was on the stand. Can you describe what they did, what people are talking about? Did you see any mistakes?
Well, I'll be honest. I was surprised that he – that not necessarily that he apologized, but then when he said the two things he said, you know – because here's the way cross-examination works. Generally, whenever anybody testifies about anything – That opens him up to full cross-examination about the subject. So it's not like you can pick and choose what you're going to testify to. If you're going to testify about, and take, for example, George Zimmerman, oh, I didn't know he was, you know, how old he was. I thought he was just a little bit younger than me. Well, if the prosecution would have been prepared, I think they could have sat there and grilled him for like a half an hour on that issue and about everything he knew and what he saw. And I think that – and so it was an extremely risky move. It clearly paid off for Mark O'Meara because he got out of there unscathed, but – had the prosecution been more prepared, I think it could have opened up a can of worms for Mark O'Meara, you know. And then there's the other
now,
issue
who,
about
who is Mark O'Meara? Is that George's attorney?
That's George's attorney. That's
okay.
Correct.
Okay. So, in other words, you think that the prosecution wasn't could have been a lot harder on George Zimmerman and just didn't take the opportunity? Why do you think that is?
Well, one, I don't think they wanted to see their case exposed. I don't think they were prepared to litigate the case that day. You know, and where they come from in Jacksonville, Jacksonville's such a conservative area and it's such a pro-prosecution area. I think they thought that, you know, they were expecting to get the same type of judicial, you know, just consideration that they get there. And, you know, and Seminole County is no pushover, don't get me wrong, but I think, you know, the judge basically made it clear to them, like, listen, you know, unless you got something more, I'm going to grant him bond. And you know, they're in an unfamiliar territory. Listen, whenever I go to a place that I'm not, that I don't practice regularly, it's, you know, you hold back a little bit because you don't want to test your boundaries too much.
Mm-hmm. I see, and you don't want to show your hand either, and so.
Well, I don't know. I don't know they have a hand to show.
Well, there you go. So, were you surprised when George Zimmerman apologized on the stand?
No, I mean, listen, you can think whatever you want about George Zimmerman, but he killed a person, and I don't care what you say about him. I would believe that he's extremely remorseful for what happened. There's no doubt in my mind that he's remorseful for what happened. He's not a criminal. He's just somebody that used very poor judgment and you know, and things of that. So I don't doubt that am I surprised he apologized on the stand a little bit? Am I surprised he apologized? No, not at all. I'm sure that he probably wants nothing more than to apologize. You know, so that didn't surprise me in the grand scheme of things that much.
You said that he's not a criminal. He's just somebody that used poor judgment. I know you're speaking on legal terms, but I think there's a lot of people who feel that, okay, maybe he didn't violate the letter of the law, but what he did was wrong. And I guess from your point of view
I agree with that. I think what he did was wrong too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like guns in the least bit. I think I've never heard of anything good coming out of a situation involving a gun. But listen, I'm not, unlike most people, though, I'm not willing to just assume that Trayvon Martin didn't do anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's my problem is that, you know, here's the thing is that, and I've said this before, I think I've said it every time I've been on here, I don't believe George has the ability to make up a lie that quickly. I mean, we're talking within like 10 minutes, he had to come up with this elaborate, you know, story, and I don't think anybody could come up with this lie about everything that happened, and then there'd be some snippets of evidence, independent of what he knew other people saw, that somewhat support what he told law enforcement that happened. I don't think he placed those wounds in the back of his head. I don't think he banged his head against the floor, the ground on purpose. I don't, you know, and so I'm not going to believe the conspiracy. I think that Trayvon Martin probably did do something that was inappropriate, and so, you know, and I leave it at that. You know, I don't believe in guns in general, but I do believe in the law, and if the law says you can have a gun and the law says you can defend yourself, well, you know, so be it.
We've been through this topic before, but I want to touch on it again. Here's the scenario: does the Stand Your Ground law allow you to initiate and cause a problem to get that person to come and attack you and then you kill them? I mean, if they can prove that George Zimmerman was the original aggressor, would the Stand Your Law law be applied at all, or can they throw it out if he's proven to be the aggressor?
Yes and no. Here, and for those of you that actually read my blog, I posted a kind of a blog on the specific issue just this weekend. It boils down to this. It's whether or not George Zimmerman provoked Trayvon Martin. And by law, to legally provoke somebody, you have to either assault them, which is a threat to attack them, or you have to actually attempt to attack them, such as throw a punch but miss, okay? That's what a provoking a fight is, basically either using words or actions to cause the other person to think that you're about to hit them or something like that. You know, and I realize that we don't have both sides of the story, but there's nothing that – but on the other side of the note, what my blog shows is that merely to walking up to somebody and talking to them or saying, hey, who are you, or even calling them names, saying – even if you would have said, hey, you fucking whatever, excuse my language.
Mm-hmm. No, okay.
By law, that's not considered provoking behavior so that a person loses their right to defend themselves. So on one hand, if it can be shown that George Zimmerman provoked the fight by either some type of assault or attempted battery, then he's technically not entitled to rely on stand your ground. There's an exception to that. On the other hand, if he's walked up to Trayvon Martin and is like, who are you, or something along those lines, that would not be enough justification for Trayvon Martin to then attack him and George Zimmerman to have been considered the provoker.
What if George – and I'm not suggesting this is the case. This is a hypothetical because I want to understand the stand your ground law. What if George would have said, hey, you N-word? Would that be enough in the eyes of the law to provoke Trayvon to take action?
No, that would not.
Really? So no speech? No.
Only if it's a threat. And I post this, using poor language, like, you know, is not enough. It has to be like a threat, like
I'm going to kick your ass or something.
Yeah, exactly, right. That type of thing. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But anything else is not enough. You know, anything short of a threat or an assault or an attempted battery or a battery, of course. Is words, it's the nursery rhyme, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, you know. So that's that. Now, let's assume that whatever George did, let's just assume that whatever he did, he's legally considered the person that provoked the fight under the law, not under what people think, but under the law. Let's assume that he's mm-hmm. the person that legally provoked the fight. If all he did was say, hey, I want to kick your butt, or you know, or grabbed him by the, like, say, his arm and said, hey, who are you? Well, if Trayvon Martin would to not only respond and defend himself, but then would to have, say, defended himself initially, then gets George Zimmerman on the ground, as we, or, you know, George is saying happened, and is beating his head against the ground, because Trayvon's response would have been disproportionate to the amount of force that George Zimmerman initially used, George Zimmerman's right to defend himself is restored, even if he initially provoked the fight. And if once it's restored, if he reasonably believes that A, he can't retreat under the circumstances, and B, deadly force is necessary to end this, you know, the assault on him, he can resort to his gun. And that was how the law was even before Stand Your Ground. The law has always been that way.
Well, that's screwed up. Let me just point something out. Richard, if I was on the street and some guy came up and just gently grabbed my arm and said, hey, what the hell are you doing here? I'd kick him right between the legs.
But stop, though. And here's what happens many times, though, and this is where I disagree with you. This is not an uncommon scenario, though, is that someone goes and starts a fight with someone they shouldn't have started the fight with. You know, and so what happens is the guy they started the fight with finishes the fight, but then there's a difference between finishing the fight and then taking it too far. And so sometimes you'll have situations where people will get, you know, they'll defend themselves and then they get them on the ground and then they start pummeling them until they start knocking their teeth in. You know, there's a limit. And so, yeah, you would be justified in kicking him in the crotch to get him to go away. But then if he, let's say he fell on the ground and you started kicking him in his face as hard as you can and you wouldn't stop, that's no. Then the other guy can defend himself because you responded disproportionately.
Here's my argument to that. I'm assuming that he's going to get up and try and kill me because I don't know him and he grabbed me. So I want to stop him. And I'm just going to just beat the crap out of him to stop him. And that's what I think that's legit. I'm not a legal person, but that's what I would do, you know. So anybody that comes up and grabs my arm, be careful because I'm going to kick you right in the nuts. So just be careful.
Well, you know, that sounds all good and dandy, and you say that, but I'm willing to bet that if someone came up and grabbed you that you were scared of,
mm-hmm.
you may kick them initially, but the next thing you're going to do is you're going to run.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
You're right. I don't believe you. There's no way in the world you would sit there and not only kick them, but then keep kicking them and keep kicking them. You would run immediately to wherever you're going from. You know, and that's the point, is that, you know, your response would have been disproportionate, unreasonable, given what it was. Now, on the other hand, if someone came up and grabbed you and had a knife in your hand and they were still holding on to you after you kicked them, yeah, then you could probably do it. But, you know, there's no evidence that George got out of his car waving his gun around or something like that. That's just, and I know people want to speculate that maybe he was doing something like that, but speculate all you want. There's nothing to support that theory, even if, you know, that's all there is to it.
Well, isn't it bad enough that George Zimmerman actually got out of his car? I mean, isn't that just kind of the crux almost of the prosecution?
You know, I don't know if it's bad or not. I don't know, but I, you know what's funny is that if Trayvon Martin would have actually been a burglar, no one would be questioning what – everybody would be calling George Zimmerman a hero. You know, this is the whole hindsight's 2020. I don't know. Do I agree with it? You know, I don't know. You know, maybe the reason – I'm sure that he probably felt more safe getting out of the car because he had a concealed weapon on him. But, you know, here he is in a neighborhood. People's houses are getting broken into left and right. And he doesn't want this guy to get away. I'm not saying you know, it's one of those things, again, morally I don't really agree with the whole gun thing, but – It doesn't seem that much out of the realm that he would do something like that. You know, we're only second guessing him now because of what happened. But under any other circumstances, we'd be like, oh well, you know, that's what you expect.
Well, okay, that's true. But so, okay, let's theorize now that we're in court, and how in the world can the prosecution prove anything because Trayvon's dead? It's almost like if George Zimmerman was guilty, they can't prove it anyway because the person that he was, you know, that he had the confrontation with is dead. Are the witnesses reliable? I don't think so. It's been pretty much proven that Trayvon's girlfriend lied about the phone call. It's not, you know, obviously it's not 100% solid.
I don't think there's I think it seems to me like she is truthful to some extent about the phone call.
Well, what happened, apparently, I was researching this when the time came. The day, the night that he was shot, that's when the All-Star game started, and the girlfriend was tweeting all night about the game and the players, didn't say anything about Trayvon at all, nothing. And then, let's see, the day that that she said she was in the hospital because she was traumatized, she was actually tweeting about getting her hair done at McDonald's, never said a word about it. You know, so there's some different, what she's saying and what she tweeted about are two different things. Like, you know, you could take it to another argument and say, well, she wasn't
tweeting.
Well,
I mean, that's going to be a simple thing, though, to verify.
Right.
You just pull her phone records. I mean, and, you know, and I don't have any doubt that, I have no doubt that whatever she came up with 5 weeks after the fact is somewhat
skewed.
Yeah, because you know there's no way that this woman remembers that young remembers all these specific things 5 weeks after the fact, and I have no doubt she was influenced by all these other people that wanted her to say something that supported, you know, what they their position in the case.
Don't you think Trayvon's parents are amazing? I just think they're great. I mean, they've been so calm and rational. It's everybody else around them that's been, you know, really stirring things up unnecessarily. What do you think of his parents?
Well, I mean, the mother, obviously, she's very strong, and you know, and I couldn't imagine being in her situation because. And my gut feeling is that I think she does believe that this is an accident, but it's just like me. I don't really justify. While legally I think George Zimmerman's not guilty, I don't think he's innocent. I don't. You know, if there wouldn't have been the gun, none of this would have happened. The same, you know, and whatnot. So, and I think that's a problem. You know, and the other thing is that she's probably got Ben Crump. You know, no matter how much he says he's, I have no doubt he's you know, fighting for them left and right, but. The reality is that if this case gets dismissed on the stand your ground law, the law also provides that a person that's given immunity from based upon stand your ground can't be sued civilly. So, you know, and he has no dog in this fight. Really, it's up to the state attorney to win,
right.
Or he can't sue. At least George Zimmerman. And so, you know, that's what things I think he's concerned about more than anything.
We do have a question, Kimster. We have a question from the chat room. What is that question, my dear?
Actually, I don't have a question from the chat room right now, but
oh.
I do have a caller, and that's Talisa is on the line. She wanted to talk to Mr. Hornsby.
Okay, Talisa, are you there?
I'm still here, sweetheart.
Okay, Talisa, what is your question, my dear?
Well, I just wanted to tell Richard that I love him. I read his blog all the time, and I really, really respect him. And I agree with him on the N-word because I'm Cherokee, and I've been called Redskin, Squaw. And when I get those, I look at them and I say, thank you. Jason, I want to go back to the lie. I disagree with him on the lie. Because we've seen Casey Anthony come up with 10 lies in 15 seconds. Not 15 minutes, but 15 seconds.
So you think that it is possible that George Zimmerman came up with all of that whole story?
Absolutely.
Richard, what's your response?
You know, don't forget, I mean, law enforcement was confronting Casey Anthony with one inconsistency after another. And and she just stuck to her lie, and even though her lie didn't fit the evidence. Now, I haven't seen George Zimmerman's interview yet, but something tells me that they're going to have been confronting him with things, and he's going to have been able to explain, give an explanation that's not only consistent, but that fits in with the evidence as they found it that night. And I've just been doing this too long to know that it's impossible to come up with such an elaborate lie that fits the evidence. And remember, it's not only fits the evidence as the person telling the lie knows it, it fits the evidence as was discovered by the law enforcement after the fact, independent of whatever the defendant knew. And that's impossible to do. And so I think George Zimmerman's general explanation is probably true. Do I have, you know, the exact words that were used between him and Trayvon Martin? You know, sure, that's always going to be up for debate. Maybe he did say a word that he probably doesn't, you know, didn't want to admit he said, but the basics, I think, are probably true.
Hey, thank you for calling in, my dear. I really appreciate it. You take care, okay?
Thank you, Trish.
Take care.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Thank you.
Kimster, we have some questions from the chat room. Kimster?
Hi, I'm here.
We have questions from the chat room?
Yes. Steely Dan wanted to ask Mr. Hornsby if he thinks that there's a history of racism in Sanford.
I got to be honest. I don't think I have a large enough historical perspective to be able to give an honest answer on that. I mean, I've grown up in Central Florida all my life. I personally think law enforcement in general is racist, just period. And I can tell you that Seminole County, you know, granted, even though Democrats make up a majority of the residents and African Americans make up a large percentage of the residents, it still is predominantly skewed Republican because there's so many that don't vote. And they, you know, and I think there's a general Southern, you know, racial issues there. As far as does it have a history compared to other places in Central Florida, I wouldn't say it's any worse than any other Central Florida communities. And nothing, to be honest, that just jumps out at me. But I think law enforcement in general is just is biased or racist. So, you know, maybe I just don't see it as much. And again, I'm not African American, so I don't know what it is to live every day in Sanford and, you know, experience their experience.
Kimster, do we have any other questions from the chat room?
Yes, I have another one from Steely Dan. He wants to know if following someone in a car slowly down the street, is that a reason for you to stand your ground if they get out and come after you?
I mean, you mean the person that's being followed?
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, here's the thing. Could the person that was being followed stand their ground if someone got out and came towards him? Yes, there's nothing that says that there's no duty to retreat, period. But here's the thing. It all depends on what that person that got out of his car did. If the person that got out of his car was walking up to him just at a normal pace and was like, who are you? Identify yourself. Well, then the person that was being followed has no right to suddenly just attack the inquiring person or anything like that. You know, but if the person, let's say George Zimmerman got out of his car and he had like his gun out, or let's say he was holding it like he was holding his gun, you know, even though it was behind his thing, then maybe Trayvon would have been justified. But there is nothing illegal per se about just getting out of your car and basically confronting someone and saying, who are you? That's not illegal. And it's not so much confronting that's the issue. It's whether or not George Zimmerman legally provoked the altercation. That's the key question that needs to be decided.
Well, and that's the thing. It's going to depend on George Zimmerman on the stand, don't you think? He's going to have to take the stand. Or do you think he will?
Oh, yeah, he's going to have to take the stand, and I don't think he's scared to take the stand. I mean, the fact he got – trust me, I have no doubt that Mark O'Meara, that they planned that, you know, the apology and all that stuff, and I have no doubt that Mark said, listen, everything could go downhill, because I know I would have done it, and I know Mark's an incredible attorney. I have no doubt that Mark sat there for hours and said, all right, if they start cross-examining you, you need to be prepared to tell the whole story. And they went through it to the T. Remember, they don't have the copy of his original statement, so Mark had to be that confident that he would tell the exact same story that he originally told.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, he'll have to testify. And here's the thing. If he tells the story and all the other evidence, such as the ballistics, such as, you know, other eyewitnesses, and things of that nature, conform to what George Zimmerman said, I mean, there's really no reason not to believe him unless you just simply don't want to believe him.
Right. And don't you think that's a possibility, though, in this case, that even if he comes across truthful, that the jury won't believe him?
It is a possibility, but it's remember the judge decides first before the judge decides it first in a standing ground motion, and a judge legally he's subject to more scrutiny than a jury, and so he can't just decide not to believe somebody. He has to base it on some type of objective criteria, like, oh, George Zimmerman was impeached really bad on all these issues or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the law says. As far as the jury, sure, the jury could disregard him, but I have a feeling that if the jury hears all the evidence, as I believe, like, that George Zimmerman, you know, is there have been a rash of break-ins, and George Zimmerman tells the story, I don't think the jury's going to just simply disbelieve him unless they're scared of the racial fallout.
I do think that is a real possibility. I really do, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think George Zimmerman's innocent, but I also do not think he's guilty at all. But I could see a jury being like, you know, we've got bigger people to worry or bigger issues to worry about than George Zimmerman, and find him guilty just because they're afraid of, you know, what could happen.
Okay. We have a question from the chat room from Joy Pathology, and she wants to know, has the medical examiner been tainted by mistakes, by perhaps looking at an autopsy and trying to get, you know, how sometimes a medical examiner might get the answers that the prosecution wants? Is that possible in this case? Do you know anything about the examiner and that whole situation there?
Well, I don't know who the actual at the medical examiner's office in Volusia County. There's a chief medical examiner, and then there's a deputy. He's a foreign guy, and the main one's a female. And it all depends on who did it. I've actually dealt with both of them in a previous murder case I had. But remember, when they did the autopsy, there didn't seem to be a lot of pressure from the prosecution's office, because the autopsy would have been done right away.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm willing to bet they found whatever they found, and they made their conclusions before there was a lot of political pressure on them. That's just the way it works.
Okay, got it. Another question from the chat room. George wasn't actually arrested on the night he shot Trayvon. So even though he wasn't arrested, the police department took the photos and all of the injuries sustained. I guess they just did that as part of the investigation, right? They thought something was up, and then they cleared him, or how did that work?
Well, they detained him. They definitely detained him. They detained him from the minute they got there until he was taken to the station and questioned. And then once, and again, this is where I don't think this is why I believe his story is probably credible, is that they obviously questioned him probably for an hour, if not hours. And every time they had a question, his version of the story fit the question, and he was able to explain it. So they collect all the evidence. Listen, there's going to be pictures of his head. There's going to be pictures of his nose. There's going to be medical records if he went to the doctor the next day. And none of this stuff, there's no conspiracy. They didn't make this stuff up after the fact. And that's all there is to it. And if there isn't, you know, medical records, and if there isn't pictures of him by law enforcement, well, then there's a real big problem.
Now, do we know the witnesses in the case? There are several. And I'm having trouble kind of grasping if they're reliable or not. What have you found in your research, Richard? We're talking with Richard Hornsby, attorney from Florida, richardhornsby.com, an amazing blog. You should go there every day and read. Richard, what have you found the witnesses? Do you find them to be pretty credible?
You know, well, obviously I don't think that the young girl is going to be that credible of a witness in the grand scheme because of how gratuitously she came forward and said...
That's Trayvon's girlfriend.
The Trayvon's girlfriend. There are other witnesses that, you know, I think the problem is a lot of these witnesses that the state identified came forward after there was all the backlash to George Zimmerman. And I think that they remembered things that were incriminating George just because they once they started hearing about the situation... like the person, apparently someone claims they saw two people running, and then, you know, and you have the lady who says, I guess to answer the real question is, I don't know who the new witnesses are, but clearly the prosecution has identified new witnesses that provide testimony that is contrary to what not only George Zimmerman says, but to what one of the other witnesses that we know that exists that was actually favorable to George Zimmerman said.
And how many witnesses have you heard of that are favorable to George Zimmerman?
Well, I'm aware of the one person, the guy, I believe it's a guy who went like up his house and down upstairs to his house and then downstairs and was calling 911, and he's the one who said he saw initially George on the bottom. That one is the one that's obviously favorable to George Zimmerman. You know, and then there's this other witness who we know about who says that they saw George over Trayvon Martin. But that's not really that surprising because once George would have shot Trayvon, you know, he would have had to got up. And I have no doubt that he probably hovered over Trayvon to see if there was anything he could do or, you know, or something of that nature. So the fact that he was over Trayvon Martin is not that, you know, that surprising. I don't think it's that incriminating once everything's put into perspective.
Here's a problem I see. We have a dead teenager. We have a guy with a gun who was not a policeman. And you and I have discussed this. And to me, George Zimmerman was in charge. He was the one. He was the adult. He was the one most responsible. And I think had he not had that gun and been out of his car at some point, Trayvon would not have been shot. You have a young kid. He's probably scared. He sees a guy coming toward him. We don't know what was said. He, you know, reacted probably the way that he thought he needed to. Here's the problem. Trayvon's dead. George is going to say what's best for him. And I am so conflicted about this case, Richard. I didn't even know. I go back and forth constantly. I still state that George Zimmerman was the adult with the gun, and he is the primary reason why this happened. Had he not done what he did, had he just stayed in the car the whole time, none of this would have happened. How in the world can the prosecution even prove anything? Because all they have to go on is by what George said or what George says.
Well, I mean, I've been spending the last 40 minutes explaining how this study could prove it. If they would find evidence that contradicts what George Zimmerman claims happened.
Well, but he can come up with evidence. He can come up with a story that will explain the contradiction.
But here's the thing: he could come up with a story. But the story he came up with right then, right there on the scene, and it's apparently that story matches other evidence of which George Zimmerman was unaware existed. Like George Zimmerman had no idea that this other guy saw the altercation. George Zimmerman didn't go bashing his head against the concrete after he shot Trayvon Martin because we have witnesses that saw him immediately after the shot. So you can't make that stuff up. It's impossible. And so I just don't choose to believe that George Zimmerman lied, and I don't choose to believe that George Zimmerman knew what this other evidence would show. And anybody that doesn't want to believe that just simply chooses not to believe, even though there's no other explanation. And that's all I can tell you. You know, it's like a woman that's pregnant. We know at some point that she was impregnated by a male. Some people can choose to believe that it didn't happen, but we know mm-hmm. it did. You know, and it's the same thing with those injuries. We know that at some point George Zimmerman's head hit against the ground, and we know based upon at least two witnesses that it wasn't after he shot Trayvon Martin that the injuries occurred.
Exactly, but here's the key, and this is what we've talked about, and this is where I go round and round. What did George say or do to Trayvon? Did he say or do enough that would eliminate the stand your ground law for his defense? That's the problem.
Well,
and,
right, but you stop there. But let's assume that by whatever he said, he provoked Trayvon. I don't think whatever he said gave Trayvon the right to not only to attack him, but to get him on the ground and start hitting his head against the ground. I just don't believe that. And you keep saying And I know, but here's the thing, and I don't choose to believe that Trayvon Martin was completely without fault. I just, you know, everybody, he has this picture painted about him of this, you know, this young, but, you know, George Zimmerman came up with an explanation, and, you know, and if he does have something on it, you know, that's the thing. Think about it. We know from the funeral director that Trayvon Martin had no injuries on him. That means that George Zimmerman at least never punched him or hit him or did something to cause any serious injury. I mean, how do you just ignore that? The only explanation is that maybe George Zimmerman was telling the truth.
Well, and that could be. But again, it just goes back to, if he didn't have a gun, he was legal, I know, and all of that's legal, and we can't bring that up, but it's still, on a human level, just really bothers me that he had a gun and he got out of the car. If he just would have stayed in the car, this would have been fine, but he didn't.
And here's the thing, and I agree with you, and that's what I think, that's what a civil court is for, so that, you know, the parents could have sued him or something like that. I just don't believe that everything should happen to be a crime. That's the problem. Is that, and that's the way the law used to work. It used to be that, you know, the gray area of life was for the civil courts. It was only for the black and white areas that you charge people with crimes. But now, in our society, we're so touchy-feely about everything that we want to make every single thing a crime, even though it's just a tragic situation that was no criminal intent involved by anybody.
And on that note, and it was a brilliant note, as usual, Richard Hornsby, we're going to wrap it up. Kimster, do we have any more questions? I don't think we do.
Nope,
I think we've got them all.
Any.
Okay. Well, Richard, we're going to have you back on real soon. And as this case continues to go, when did you say you thought it would go to trial, 214?
It's not going to go to trial until sometime next year.
Until in the 13th. Okay. Well, you're probably right. So we have lots to discuss between now and then. Richard Hornsby, attorney at law, richardhornsby.com, an amazing blog. I would suggest everybody go to it every single day. Thank you very, very much for joining us again and for helping us understand everything that's going on in this case and many others.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, Kimster. You know, Richard Hornsby, are you there, Kimster?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Richard Hornsby has mellowed a bit, don't you think? Because, like, during the Casey Anthony trial, he'd get real riled up, and I always used to think he was mad at me, and I'd cry and have to go to therapy. But now he's not doing that as much anymore, you know? Kind of amazing.
You guys are just getting used to each other.
That's,
you know?
It. We're becoming friends. We're touchy-feely friends over the phone. That's it. Yay.
That's right. And by the way, before we go to our next segment, I just want to let you know that the cat is in here, and there is a big bee in here. I have
Ooh.
The window open, and a bee came in, and now the cat is trying to catch the bee for me because it was attacking me. So she's just protecting me, so if you guys hear her in the background, she's just catching the bee.
Or if we hear you screaming like you're on fire, we'll know you got stung, so we're fine.
Yes.
We can handle that. Okay, Kimster, tell us about, this is a very interesting kind of cumulative Webb Sleuth's hot cold case. What's going on?
Okay, well, let me get started here. Kathleen Thomas, Rebecca Dowski, Robin Edwards, David Nobling, Richard Call, Cassandra Riley, Anna Maria Phelps, Daniel Lohr. What do all of these people have in common? They are all the victims of the Colonial Parkway murderer from 1986 to 1989 in Virginia. And this killer, this serial killer, has not been caught yet.
Mm.
So there has been some activity in the past few years. There were reports of DNA testing that were going to be done, but none of the results have been posted on Webb Sleuth that I could find, and I looked on the internet and couldn't find any. I saw the mainstream media reports that it was going to be done and that we were going to have results by 2011, but I still haven't seen anything. So maybe
mm-hmm.
one of our members can post some follow-up information about that. And also, in an odd turn of events, Fred Atwell, the whistleblower who helped break the story that the FBI had lost control of 84 highly graphic crime scene photos in this case, can you believe that, in the fall of 2009. It now appears he is headed for jail himself. The FBI
Whoa.
And the Virginia State Police are working on that case. So there's a lot of twists and turns to this serial killer.
Wait, now why is that guy going to prison? What's going on? Do you know?
I'm not quite sure what is going on with him, if it has something to do with him losing control of the 84 graphic crime scene photos. I'm not sure. But that was pretty – I mean, it's bad enough that there are crime scene photos on the Internet, and there are crime scene photos on the Internet. But when you have a case that hasn't been solved yet, that's – you know, losing the integrity of the case completely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, so go ahead.
Oh, no, ask questions. That's fine. We also have the brother of Kathleen Thomas. She was the first name that I mentioned. He is still posting on Web Sleuths, and I think his last post was just February of this year. And he would love to see more members get involved in sleuthing this serial killer. So just want to remind everybody to go to www.websleuths.com and click the link in the upper right-hand corner area where you see the pictures of the victims of the Colonial Parkway serial killer, and maybe you can help put these clues together and get this killer to come to justice. You know, sometimes I wonder, is this the same serial killer that's moved on to another area or something?
Absolutely.
I don't know.
And that's the scary thing.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of similarities, only in that the people that I just read to you, most of them were couples. So either they decided
Do you know how they were killed? Were they killed in their cars, like Son of Sam? Or I'm not real familiar with that.
Yeah. You need to go to the site, go to websleuths.com and look, because there are some differences in each one.
I've heard that's
down.
A really good site to go to, websleuths.com. I'll check it out.
Yeah.
So thank you.
This is from our serial killer forum, which is, you know, the one that we just created at the latter part of last year, and there's been just a lot of activity there. So
that's an amazing forum, the serial killer forum on Web Sleuths. I've had law enforcement tell me they really like it. I mean, they think it's very impressive. And you know what, Kimster, you and I don't do anything. It's everybody else doing all the work, you know?
Yeah.
So thank you for that. So anyway, Kimster, what else do you have for us? Anything?
That's all I have. I see that Curry has not yet caught that bee, so I go find a fly swatter after we
close. Or something like that. There you go. Be careful. Don't get stung. We don't like having screaming people on our show. I have enough of that in real life. Okay, everybody.
Well, after reading that case of serial killers, I might scare everybody a lot.
No kidding.
Huh?
That is frightening, because that guy could still be out there. That's what's scary. My guess is he might be in prison or dead, but no matter what, he needs to be caught. And you know what? You listening out there, come to websleuths.com/forums. Check out the serial killer forum. Maybe you'll see something that nobody else has seen and you can post about it. We would love you to do that. And you can also come on and check and see if there's any other cases that you're interested in. I don't have an update on our missing member's husband, Steve Jones. We had his wife on last week, and we're still working on that. Still have not found Mr. Jones. We'll keep you updated on that. Sierra Lamar, there are still searches going on for that. There are so many people missing and murdered that need our help. So just go to websleuths.com/forums. Even if you don't want to post, just read and get interested, and I'm sure you can find something on there. Trust me, once you get into it on websleuths.com, it's really hard to get out of it. You're hooked for life. So, Kimster, thank you for everything you do on Web Sleuths and Web Sleuths Radio. You're a doll. And
you're
I will
so
talk
welcome.
To you next week. And thank you to everybody in the chat room and to everybody who is listening. It's Web Sleuths Radio, where we talk about current events and true crime, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody. Bye-bye.